Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. We're going to travel to a bunch of different places in the course of the next 2 hours. We're going to begin our show with Shibli Talhami, one of the leading thinkers of the Middle East, talking about updates going on there. Changes by the minute, by the second. And I think this world-shattering effect on the notion of world democracy in the Arab people is an amazing thing to talk about. We'll start there, and then we'll talk about single-payer health. Healthcare is being debated in the state legislature. But around the country, and in one of our sister states, Vermont, they're seriously considering a single-payer health care system for their state, something people said could not be done in Maryland. Well, one of our state senators, one of our members of the House delegates, and others are saying yes. We have two women here from Vermont who are fighting for just that. And, of course, Dr. Margaret Flowers is always fighting for that here in the state of Maryland and around to talk about that. And then we will switch gears and talk to three women who wrote a book called The Obama Effect, Dr. Heather Harris, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, and other amazing scholars from communities of color from around the country who analyzed the 2008 election and are looking at it now. So we'll talk to them in the second hour. But right now we have to look at the state of the roads and turn this over to traffic to make sure you know which way to go and which way not to go. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Shibli Talhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park and also a non-resident senior fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute. And Dr. Shibli Talhami, welcome back. It's lovely to have you back with us once again.
My pleasure.
I'm just, you know, you're a man who we've met a few times. You've been on the show a number of times. Your history in studying the Middle East and being part of that world is known to many, and I'm just curious for a moment if you will reflect about your own, if I might say, shock and amazement at what has occurred in Tunisia, in Egypt, what's going on throughout the Middle East and the Arab and Muslim world. I'm sure you, as many others, did not expect this, and I'm curious about your process of reflection on all of this.
Well, first of all, this obviously is amazing, extraordinary. We've never seen anything like it. You know, even in contemporary history, not just in the Middle East, there are so many layers to it that are interesting. But I could tell you, you know, if you look at how the world in the Arab world has been turned upside down in 1 month, you know, a month ago, most Arabs were terrified of their governments. Today, most governments are terrified of their public. I mean, it's an extraordinary, reversal in just 1 month. It doesn't matter what happens almost in terms of the changing of governments. The calculations have changed. The sense of power has changed. If you people are talking about demonstrations in many Arab countries. There are many, obviously, Yemen and Algeria and Jordan and Bahrain and even outside the Arab world in places like Iran, for sure. But what has really changed is the empowerment that you see in other places and how people are talking, how people are writing. It's a completely changed tone. And when you ask me, you know, is it predictable? Well, to be honest, you know, over the past decades, particularly past decade, when we've been studying public opinion every single year and more. I mean, there are at least one major annual public opinion poll in the Arab world. And every year I come back and I conclude that the question has never been when will Arab find a reason to revolt. The question has always been, why haven't people revolted already? Because they've had enough indication of a widening gap. But here was the reason for the surprise, is that most people assumed, well, you know, governments have learned to deal with it nonetheless. A lot of people predicted revolutions that didn't happen. And in any case, you need heavy-duty political organizations to be able to turn that anger into, public action in a way that the governments would feel the heat. And lo and behold, we have Tunisia and Egypt come, and you have non-ideological revolutions started by young people with no major political organizations, primarily rallying on an information revolution, the impact of which we're only beginning to understand. And so it is huge.
And I think there are a couple of things I want to explore. Your article today was really fascinating, so I want to get into the heart of what you're telling America about the Middle East and its effect on us and vice versa. But this is also, I think, could begin to be the beginning of turning the perception in the West and in America about the Arab world, about who the Arab people are, about the essence of the Arab world. That I think that's part of this shock, I think. This, the nonviolent nature of these movements, seeing men and women standing together, seeing women with Western clothing and nothing covering their heads, to women covering their heads, to women in burqas, to men in suits, to men in hijabs, the sight itself is kind of, I think, altering the perception we in the West have of the Arab world.
Absolutely. And I think when you know, one of the absolutely striking things about the Egyptian revolution is you had this very diverse segments of the public, from secular to religious, from Christian to Muslim, from young to old. It started by young people, better educated. It wasn't, one of the things that we have to understand is this was not a food riot. Obviously, food is important, and widening gap of rich and poor is important. But in the end, this was really about dignity, about people being fed up of being humiliated by the governments, of not being empowered to exercise the rights. And you can see it in the type of people who mobilized in the first place. These were people who were well off. Wael Ghanem was a very good example of that, a 31-year-old who was a Google executive making a good living, mm-hmm. well-educated. He didn't have to do this. And so this is clearly something that, and it was not ideological. It was very different from the Iranian Revolution. There was, even though there was anger with American foreign policy, the chant was peaceful, peaceful, peaceful. We want Mubarak out. It was not death to America. It wasn't death to Israel. It wasn't death to anyone. It was really about we want freedom and Egypt above all. And that's extraordinary. And it does send a signal. It tells you how distorted our analysis of the Arab world has become in the past decade when we see it strictly through the prism of Islam or the Islamic world or even Islamic militancy. How it distorted our analysis of what actually takes place in the daily lives of people in Arab and Muslim countries. This is really a powerful example that should make us think again our assumptions about how we view the region.
I wonder if you can talk a bit about how you think this will change our American interaction with Arab and Muslim nations. What might come of this? Because I think that clearly the United States government was not prepared for this, isn't still quite sure how to react to it. And you see it spreading, Bahrain, the streets of Tehran, the Tahrir squares in every Arab country. There's something afoot here, and I think that it's going to change the dynamic. And I wonder if you... not to ask you to be prescient, but to list kind of portend a bit about how this might shift power balances in our conversations internationally.
Well, first, it's obviously going to shift a lot of the conversations here, certainly among elites and academics and the media, in part because what people have observed is something different from what they've assumed. So that's a good thing. But when it comes to government policy, it doesn't matter which administration, Obama administration, Bush administration, Clinton administration, by and large, typically, governments are sort of designed to be more reactive than to think long-term about changing policy for mm-hmm. a lot of reasons. And so when events are happening on this scale so rapidly, you're basically in crisis management mode, and very often you don't take the time to sit back and think if you have to reassess all of your assumptions. And this is a time, really, obviously you have to react. There's a lot of American interests at stake, and they have to be addressed. But it's a time to sit back, because we have a lot of contradictions in the profile that we have had in the Middle East in the way we've defined our interests. And frankly, the United States clearly believes in democracy and freedom. Every administration speaks of it, I think believes it. But the reality of it is that there are priority American strategic interests in that part of the world, such as, you know, fighting the Iraq war, fighting a war on Al-Qaeda, maintaining heavy-duty military presence all over the region, protecting Israeli interests and seeking a particular kind of outcome for the Arab-Israeli conflict. These are strategic priorities that have trumped everything else in our policies. And so what has happened is that when we it's much easier to go an Arab leader when you need them for support in war, protecting your troops, and they say to you, well, you know, 90% of our public doesn't support us on this, to say, well, we still want your support. So in essence, we reward people for going against the aspirations of their own people. We reward leaders for going against their public opinion. And that has made us even more unpopular for that. And two, it has, in essence, inadvertently helped perpetuate repression by virtue of these leaders becoming even more insecure, being rewarded for going against the public and then having to face the public anger and containing it through repressive measures. And that kind of dilemma is ever present in so many choices every day of the week in the way we're conducting business in the region. And so far, governments have been able to ignore public opinion by and large, and in the past month, we are seeing that they can't do that anymore, and that has to pose a major challenge to the way the United States defines its interests. It requires far more than just reacting to crisis.
Two final thoughts. I wonder how you think this may affect the issue of the Palestinians and the Israeli-Palestinian question in large. I mean, interesting to watch what's going on. We haven't seen Palestinians inside of Israel proper erupt or even demonstrate. At least I've not seen it in the press, though I have seen the repression of those demonstrations by Hamas in Gaza and in the West Bank. But you know that you're dealing with a highly educated population among many Palestinians, especially in urban areas. And this means a lot, as I've talked to Palestinians overseas by phone. So I wonder, and the Israelis are really not knowing how to handle this. I mean, here's a saying, we don't have any democracies to deal with. We're the only democracy in the region. Now, you may have a democracy flourishing in Egypt right next door. So I wonder how you think this is going to change that dynamic.
First of all, on the demonstrations in the Palestinian areas, there were demonstrations. And I guarantee you that the vast majority of Palestinians, like the vast majority of Arabs, are proud of what happened in Egypt and Tunisia. And I say that because, you know, I'm a student of the region. I know I've had my, you know, sense of what is happening in terms of identity, I measure identity. And if you talk even to just the Egyptians, but other Arabs, there has not been a moment in recent history where you can say this is a moment where the vast majority of Arabs feel proud of who they are, or Egyptians certainly proud of their. I can point to two such moments. Maybe the 73 war, when Arabs performed well, and maybe 1956 after the Suez Crisis, where you had this sweeping anti-imperialism and empowerment that came out of Nasser. And, you know, those were empowering moments. And this is on par with that, even bigger. So I think, don't underestimate, whether they're demonstrations or not, this is a moment of deep pride across the region. There are obviously vested interest in existing regimes, and, you know, some people are uncomfortable, a lot of people are uncomfortable, but the vast majority of the public undoubtedly feels proud, whether it's Palestinian or not. But in terms of the actual impact on the Arab-Israeli issue, there are two things I want to say. Number one, on the Israeli-Egyptian treaty, the Israeli-Egyptian relationship has had two aspects to it. One aspect is no war, a peace treaty that was signed in 1979, and the second aspect is what emerged in the past few years as a collaborative relationship, particularly between President Mubarak and Prime Minister Netanyahu, in terms of coordinating on regional issues. The latter part is gone. I don't think it'll be go back in any near future,
mm-hmm.
because the public in Egypt is angry with Israel over the Palestine question, and that's going to limit any new government from doing that. The former part, the peace treaty, it's a mutual interest of Egypt and Israel. The military, which remains and will remain important, will want to make sure it's protected. That's not going to be challenged. But for the peace process itself, there is no question that in the short term, any idea that you can have a separate Israeli-Palestinian deal in the short term, I think, is now challenged by the changed environment. Everybody wants to see where things go, how this will settle, how the cards will fall, can it survive. The Palestinian Authority itself has been under pressure, legitimacy questions, for a variety of reasons, and obviously Mubarak had been a big backer of President Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority, as well as coordinator with Netanyahu. His demise is something that reshuffles the cards a bit. So in the short term, it really complicates any possibility of bilateral deals. But here's the thing. In the long term, of course, there are too many moving parts. We don't know how this will all be settled. No one can predict. But you can envision the following. In terms of a possible comprehensive deal, if there is an environment, a changed environment, in which Egypt is part now of a comprehensive deal to revalidate its peace treaty with Israel, it provides so much more incentive for the Israeli public, because that adds so much value to the notion of a comprehensive deal than it did just 3 weeks ago. So you can see it as, in some ways, a lot of Israelis are kicking themselves
mm-hmm.
For having wasted many opportunities while Egypt was a guaranteed ally that people took for granted. And now that ambiguity adds to some leverage when you're put forth something comprehensive on the table. So it can go either way. I can't predict. But I would say in the short term, there's no question that things are going to be relatively on hold.
Dr. Shibi Talhami, it is always a pleasure and an honor to talk with you. I deeply appreciate you taking time with us and look forward to following your thoughts as our world changes before our eyes.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Mark.
Take care, Shibli.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Shibi Talhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland College Park. We'll take a very brief break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Is it possible to have single payer in one state alone? Stay with us.